Welcome to the February audio presentation of the Journal of Cardiac Failure. I'm Paul Hauptmann, editor of the journal, and in a few moments I'll be joined by Andrew Coggin of IUPUI in Indianapolis and formerly Washington University in St. Louis, and his colleague Linda Peterson of Washington University, and then Matt Moore of Columbia University to discuss two investigations published this month. Before I do, I'll provide a brief rundown of some, but not all, the papers you will find in the current issue. Nir Uriel's group at the University of Chicago presents some interesting observations about the consequences of retained defibrillator and pacemaker leads after heart transplantation. And Scott Hummel and colleagues, including lead author Matthew Konerman at the University of Michigan, have a very interesting piece about reduced myocardial flow reserve as measured by PET and decreased left ventricular and left atrial strain in patients with risk factors for HFpEF but normal epicardial perfusion on PET. Two interesting perspectives, one by Milton Packer on possible interactions between neprilysin inhibition and GLP-1 receptor agonists, and Steve Goldsmith and colleagues on the potential role for a combined V1A-V2 receptor antagonist in chronic heart failure, raise some provocative points that will be of interest to pharmacists, clinical trialists, and heart failure clinicians. I'd like to point out that a co-author on the Goldsmith paper is Mihai Georgiadi, and it pains me to say that this is a posthumous publication since we lost Mihai last September. Dan Jacoby and his group at Yale provide a research letter entitled Time Course of Common Clinical Manifestations in Patients with Transthyretin Cardiac Amyloidosis, Delay from Symptom Onset to Diagnosis. They show what I think many of us suspect, and that is that the signs and symptoms of amyloid may be present for quite some time before a definitive diagnosis is made. Since newer therapies are in late-stage development, insights into earlier diagnosis are very useful. This paper also has relevance to a discussion we will have in a few minutes with Matt Marr. Linda and Andrew, congratulations on your pilot study entitled Dietary Nitrate Increases VO2 Peak and Performance but Does Not Alter Ventilation or Efficiency in Patients with Heart Failure with Reduced Ejection Fraction. Andrew, can you first outline the underlying thesis behind this work?
The study was stimulated by observations that dietary nitrate as a source of nitric oxide can slightly reduce the oxygen cost of exercise in healthy younger individuals. So in 2011, Linda came across a grant opportunity for studies of nutrition and heart failure, suggested that we collaborate together, and I came up with the idea that we should attempt dietary nitrate as a potential treatment in heart failure patients.
Well, and maybe you can briefly then discuss the study. It's obviously a pilot study, but the data are very interesting. So who was enrolled, and what were the primary findings?
After screening and inclusion-exclusion criteria, we ended up studying eight subjects with, you might consider it garden variety heart failure, with reduced ejection fraction, less than 45%, all on stable medical therapy. They were studied twice in a randomized double-blind crossover design with just an acute dose of beetroot juice concentrate as a source of about 12 millimoles of nitrate. It takes about 2 hours for that nitrate to be converted to nitrite and then nitric oxide. So after the subjects ingested the beet juice, we waited that long and then subjected them to both submaximal and maximal exercise tests.
And so maybe you can just delineate some of the major findings. The study, again, the study is a pilot, but the associate editors felt that the findings were very interesting and obviously can serve as a platform for additional studies. So maybe you can summarize the major findings on VO2.
Sure. Although our initial hypothesis or our interest was stimulated by reports that dietary nitrate can reduce the oxygen cost of submaximal exercise, we didn't actually see any changes in terms of efficiency or economy. However, we did find the subjects could achieve a higher power output during an incremental exercise test, and that was accompanied by a significant increase in their peak oxygen consumption as well.
So maybe I'll ask your colleague, Linda Peterson, to tell us what the next steps are. And I know there's a study being launched soon in collaboration with Andrew. Why don't you tell our listeners something about it?
Yeah. Because we saw this improvement in VO2 peak in these patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, we actually are taking this these findings and using it as a springboard for setting up a multi-center trial. We actually have an R34 to look at inorganic nitrate delivered in a pill format and doing what's necessary and sufficient to set up a multi-center trial to look at the effects on physical performance in patients with heart failure, not only with VO2 peak, but we also have another manuscript that looked at another article that looked at muscle power in patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. We also found improvements in exercise performance in patients in terms of their muscle power, their maximal muscle power produced, and in their velocity of contraction. So we're seeing improvements in muscle strength or power and also improvements in aerobic capacity. And so the next stages are to take these studies that were done with beet juice and moving it to a pill format. It should be easier to take, and some people don't like the taste of beets, so it should be easier to move to a multi-center trial with that format.
Well, sounds very interesting. I was about to go out and get some beet juice, but maybe you should sign up and get the pill instead. So congratulations again on that paper. Switch over to Matt. Matt, you provide an important service with your editorial in the February issue. It accompanies a paper entitled Myocardial Amyloid Quantification with Look-Locker Magnetic Resonance Sequence in Cardiac Amyloidosis, Diagnostic Accuracy in Clinical Practice and Histologic Validation. The authors include Eduardo Pozzo from the Cardiology Department in Hospital Clinico in San Carlos, Madrid, Spain, and colleagues at Sinai in New York. As I mentioned, Dan Jacoby also has a research letter in the February issue on delays in clinical diagnosis. So let's start this way. How do you think the study by Pozzo helps us understand the role for MR in the diagnosis of amyloid?
Yeah, so this was a retrospective analysis of individuals who underwent CMR at this institution. They studied about 174 individuals, many of whom I think the suspicion of amyloid was quite high. For example, a large percentage of the cohort had underlying multiple myeloma, which is a close associate of AL amyloid. And I think what's most revealing in this study is that the yield, if you will, clinical yield on this particular cohort was 37%. So clearly a percentage that's much higher, I believe, than most clinicians would have ever thought. Many of us still believe or used to believe that amyloid's a relatively rare and unusual condition, and there is quite a bit of emerging evidence to suggest that that's not the case.
Right, so you've been go ahead.
Yeah, concordant with, I think, actually the paper by Dan Jacoby and his group out of Yale is the concept that, there's subtle but, clinical clues to this particular diagnosis, and their group clearly highlights that the diagnosis is often delayed for years. Many patients see, four or more clinicians before a diagnosis of cardiac amyloid is established, and that's something I think that we really need to, in the heart failure community, focus on and change.
Well, you've been a big proponent of pyrophosphate imaging, and I'm wondering if the current study in any way influences the way you think about diagnostic testing, in what order you would do them, and the timing of testing?
Yeah, I think those are all good questions. In general, I think that all of these studies begin to suggest that we need to heighten our suspicion for this diagnosis and this disease. I like to say if we don't put in a differential, if we don't think about it, we're never going to diagnose it. And imaging certainly is part and parcel of that high clinical suspicion, either echocardiographic or MR imaging. What I think distinguishes pyrophosphate imaging from the latter is that in conjunction with assessment for monoclonal proteins, a positive pyrophosphate scan, again, assuming there's no substrate for AL amyloid, is 100% specific for transthyretin and amyloid, be it due to the mutation form or be due to the so-called age-related or wild-type form. So pyrophosphate or these nuclear imaging scans have an ability to actually identify a particular subtype and distinguish AL from transthyretin and amyloid, which echocardiography and MR are unable to do at this point in time.
Well, you know, as I read the paper and your editorial, one other question came to mind, and that is we're talking about diagnosis, but do you think there's any role for any of these modalities in serial testing if treatment now comes to the fore?
Yeah, and that's where I think actually probably MR has a greater role than pyrophosphate imaging. We've conducted a series of serial scans with pyrophosphate in patients with transthyretin amyloid, just looking at the natural history, and despite obvious clinical progression, worsening symptoms of heart failure, rising biomarkers, declines in functional capacity, the pyrophosphate scans don't really change even when they're quantified, whereas in MR, there's clearly an emerging evidence for measurement of extracellular volume as a tight surrogate of amyloid deposition, and the hope is that that could serve as a, again, a surrogate for response rates as these new therapies come into fruition.
Well, as usual, Matt, you've been a real leader in this area, and we learn a lot. I learned a lot from reading your editorial, and thank you for writing it. I'd also like to thank Drs. Peterson and Coggin for joining me. And if you think the February issue is interesting, we step it up even more in the upcoming March issue. Look for our tweets at JCF_online. And listen in again in mid-March. This is Paul Hauptmann on behalf of the Journal of Cardiac Failure.